I want to talk to somebody in charge.
You are not fooling anybody when you say that what happened was a natural disaster. You're lying. It was not an earthquake. It wasn't a typhoon.
Because what's really happening is that you're hiding something out there. And it is going to send us back to the Stone Age.
God help us all.
In 1954, we'd awakened something.
Well, there's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They are trying to kill it.
You have no idea what's coming.
Can you kill it?
The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in our control. And not the other way around.
Godzilla. How many of us have seen Godzilla in the last week or two? Oh, four of us. All right. Exciting. Well, you know, it's interesting because I am not really a sci-fi movie fan, but we're gonna dive in and actually use this movie as a launching pad as we dive into the series today. And so really excited to see you here today. My name's Kurt, by the way. I'm the lead pastor here at Cross Point, and welcome to the series At the Movies. As Eric said, we're looking at some of the summer blockbusters, and we're not necessarily going to be weaving them throughout the whole morning or the whole teaching, but we are using them as a launch pad because nearly every single film that's out has some kind of spiritual thread that is going on throughout the film. And so we're not necessarily endorsing these movies, but we are saying that these movies raise some interesting topics that the Bible has a lot to say about. And so, for example, in Godzilla this week, it raises some interesting questions about our past. As you saw in the trailer there, you know, Godzilla, there's something that happened with nuclear testing back in the 50s, and it aroused this beast, this Godzilla that was buried deep in the oceans, and instead of acknowledging that, bringing that to light, it was covered up, in fact, this entire area quarantined, in order that no one would find out about it, only for 50 years later for it to begin to emerge back on the scene and reveal itself. And as I was watching this, I thought, you know, isn't that a lot like life? I mean, we have this tendency to, you know, something happens and we kind of cover it up. We don't want anyone to see it. And then eventually it begins to emerge back in our lives. And oftentimes, much has happened in the movie, you know, there's a fear that's associated with this. We have these moments where we're like, wow, what if somebody finds out about this? What if this begins to be known? And so we're going to look at this idea of how do we deal with the things in our past? You know, as a parent, one of my responsibilities is to teach my children, you know, what to fear and what not to fear. And, you know, with our first child, especially with our first child, I was a first child. And so I kind of have this personal responsibility, this cautiousness that's kind of built into me, this calculated nature. And when we had our first daughter, I just remember always saying, oh, you know, don't do this. Be afraid of that. Don't touch that because, you know, and Julie and I'd kind of laugh. We kind of laugh about all of our kids are going to be in counseling for something different, I'm convinced. But the first one, you know, she's going to be sitting in a counselor's office, and he's going to be like, well, where did this come from, these fears that you have? and she's going to, you know, be talking, and it's going to somehow be traced back to her father's, you know, instilling fear in her and everything. Now, for the rest of our kids, it's something different because I don't live that way anymore. But, you know, with her, it's going to be that way. And you know, because otherwise they run into the streets and they put foil and sockets and all kinds of destructive things, right? And so we need to instill, you know, certain levels of fear into our kids. All of us probably have certain healthy levels of fear that our parents have instilled in us. At the same time, you know, some of us probably have unhealthy fears that, you know, our parents taught us that we really shouldn't be fearing. You know, for some of us, you know, maybe your parents taught you to be afraid, saying, you know, men, you know, never let someone see you cry. And so you're always afraid somebody's going to see you cry. Or ladies, you know, maybe one of the last things your mother said to you as you were exiting, leaving the home, off to college, wherever you went after high school, was never trust men. And you took that thing to heart. And so you've been dealing with that, you know, ever since then. And so, you know, it's interesting because parents aren't the only ones that teach us how to fear things. Life teaches us to fear things as well. You know, I mean, we all have life experiences. I mean, if I start with Eric right here in the front row, and we just went up and down the rows, and I had each and every one of you stand up and share briefly something you fear, something in your past that you've experienced. You say, man, if, I hope this never happens to me again. Something happened, I never want to feel that feeling again, which, by the way, we're not going to do that. Don't get nervous, right? But if I were to do that, every single one of us would have a story to share. We'd have something in our past that we say, you know, I hope I never experience that again. And there's some fear instilled in us against that particular thing. And so what we discover as we think about this is we think of, what is that thing? Is this reality right here, that our present-day fears are actually fueled by our past? And, you know, our fears today, the things we're fearful about, they aren't just about today. When every now and then we bump into something, you know, that's from our past, and it arouses these fears within us, much like arousing Godzilla. And all of a sudden, we're not only dealing with the present now, but we're also dealing with the past. You know, as a child, as my permanent teeth started growing in, my eye teeth grew in as like fangs. It's kind of weird. I mean, they grew up like way up in my gums up here. And I kind of felt like I wouldn't smile all the time. I kind of felt like it looked like a freak, you know. And I can remember as a child, we were traveling somewhere with some of our family friends, and there were some other kids in our car. And I remember this little kid, I can't remember his name, looking at me. And I knew what he was looking at. He's like staring at my mouth, you know. And I'm trying to like ignore him. So I'm just like looking out the window, right? And he's just like staring at me, and I'm trying to ignore him. Finally, you know, it's only a kid can do, right? He's like, hey, did you know your teeth are like way out there in your mouth? Did you know that? You look like a vampire. Wow, we have a sympathetic crowd for me this morning, right? Wow. You know, and so, you know, I had all kinds of nicknames at school. I mean, it was like Kurt Dracula, you know what I mean? There's all these like things. They'd ask me questions. Man, you guys are not sympathetic. I mean, I'm still dealing with this pain, in case you haven't noticed. I mean, this has like shaped me for life. But you know what? I learned something through that. What I learned is don't smile. That's what I learned as a result of that. And in fact, my mom, I don't know if she's here this morning. If not here, she'll be here later. She could tell you, if you look at, she's been separating photos through like family photo albums. And if you look at that period in my life before I got braces, you will not find many pictures of me. In fact, if you do find a picture, you'll find them only with me not smiling. And my smile kind of looked like this. You know, because I learned very early that you don't smile, because if you smile, then you get hurt. People see this, and you feel like a freak, and so that's what I begin to do. And it's strange, because some of you can relate to this, because you have some kind of disability or something that you feel like makes you stand out. And what I learned long after my teeth were straight, which, by the way, my orthodontist, he won like awards for my teeth, all right? I mean, he had like my impressions, like my before and after were on his shelf, and people'd see him, and they'd be like, wow, that is incredible. And he's like, I know, I'm good. You know, I mean, it was like a living testimony to his work right there. And so what I learned is you don't smile, because if you smile, people laugh. And what I've learned long after my teeth are straight is I still have a difficult time smiling. If I were in a picture today, as I am frequently, you know, with my kids or wherever, when they say, okay, on the count of three, smile, I kind of have to work this, you know, this cockeyed kind of smile out, because I learned at a very early age that there's pain when you smile. That is just something I carried with me. And so, That's my little sad story. We all have them, right? We all have something. Maybe you loved at one particular time and all of a sudden you got burned. And you said, you know, I will never love again. Or you trusted somebody. Other people around you said, oh, don't trust them. And you trusted them. And that person ended up not being trustworthy. And you got burned. You said, man, I will never trust that person again. Or maybe you took a risk. You tried to be vulnerable, you know, professionally or financially, whatever it would be. And God didn't come through for you the way that you thought God was going to come through. And you said, man, I will never do that again. And maybe you opened yourself up and you said, you know, I'm going to allow someone to get to know me and be intimate. And somehow in the midst of that, you got hurt in that. And you said, you know, I'm never going to open myself up again. I'm never going to be intimate. I'm never going to let anybody really see who I am. And so the fears you deal with today as an adult, they hinge on an event, albeit an isolated event, that happened somewhere in the past, or there's a period of your life where you and I, we are taught to fear. We're taught to fear. And what we're taught to do is we're taught to build walls. And so what we do is we begin, you know, to develop this safety zone. We have things like anger. And we have anger. We say, well, I'm kind of put this anger in. This is going to create a wall, because when I'm angry, then I don't have to worry about people getting close to me. They're never going to get close. And then we do things like withdraw. We withdraw, and people are like, man, why are they so disconnected all the time? I mean, there's no intimacy with them. And, you know, why do I never feel like I get to know them? Because we learn to withdraw. Or maybe we trusted someone at one particular point, and we got burned, and so we just said, you know, from this point on, I'm not going to trust anymore. Everybody's going to be held at a distance. Nobody's going to get close. And we begin to build this wall, this barrier between us and everyone else in order that we can keep this distance, that I don't get hurt again. And then what typically happens is bitterness sets in and we become very critical. Because, you know, it's interesting because we've been on the hurting end of comments. We've been on the hurting end of actions. And we thought, well, you know, it's interesting. When I begin to kind of judge others, then I'm actually the one creating the pain. I mean, they're the ones that actually end up hurting in the end. And so we oftentimes, you know, we're critical. And that actually, again, creates a barrier. You know, maybe we let our life, our finances, we kind of just went free and wild for a while and got out of control. And we said, oh, man, that'll never happen again. Everything's always, not only am I going to control my life, but I'm going to control my family's life. I'm going to watch every dollar that goes in and out of my bank account, what my spouse spends. I'm going to watch everything. I'm going to control life to the greatest extent possible, because as long as I do that, then everything's predictable and I know I won't get hurt. This is an interesting one. This one's kind of somewhat connected to being critical. Sarcasm. You know, sarcasm is a defense mechanism. Sarcasm is this place where I try to be funny, but I say something that's kind of got some points to it, kind of digs a little bit, but nobody ever really knows if it's actual reality or if I'm just joking. And so what it ends up doing in a relationship is no one ever really knows where you stand on something, because everything's just a joke. And it's a defense mechanism. It's one of the ways I keep people at a distance. I mean, there's all kinds of these. There's profession. I mean, my profession, what I choose to do with my work. I mean, you know, sometimes we choose our work, discipline or lack of discipline with our children. You know, this is one that, you know, sometimes we don't discipline our kids because of what happened in the past. We say, I never want my kids to experience what I've experienced before. And so we begin to build this wall, and the whole point of this wall is to keep people out so that no one gets close. I mean, I can barely see over it, and everyone's always kept at a distance. And then if the pain gets too deep, then this one comes in. This is a big one right here. This is a substance abuse. Substance abuse is a big one because, you know, with substance abuse, what's fascinating about this is, I don't know if you ever talked to somebody that's got a drug or alcohol problem. You know, the drugs and alcohol are never the problem. These are always symbolic of something underneath that's been hidden, something that happened where somebody said, you know, I never want to feel that again. I never want to experience that again. And so we kind of use drugs or alcohol to mask, in a sense, something that's lying beneath. And you know, it's interesting because we stand behind this wall and we try to be good husbands. We try to be good wives, we try to be good bosses, we try to be good, you know, good employees, and we're kind of like, hey, as long as you can deal with me back here, I mean, this is who I am. I came out front one time, I trusted or I loved or I, you know, I kind of got out of control and it went south for me, so I just made the decision I'll never do that again. So I mean, as long as you can relate to me back here, then I'm good. And then maybe we even become a Christian. And, you know, we become a Christian and we begin to hear someone, this voice trying to nudge us out from behind the wall, saying things like, hey, love others. You know, saying things like, you know, hey, follow me. Come on, follow me. Trust me. You're like, hey, I trusted one time. I'm never going to trust again. Or maybe we hear a voice, you know, husbands, you hear a voice that says, hey, honor your wives, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Lay your life down for your wife. And you're like, hey, I did that one time for someone and they hurt me. I'm never going to put myself out and lay my life down again. Or wives, you know, submit to your husbands. You hear a voice that says, submit to your husbands. Submit to your husband's leadership. Husbands and wives, submit to one another. You're saying, you know, I tried that once and I got hurt, so I'm going to just stand back behind the wall. And God, you know, if you can use me back here, I mean, if I can follow you from behind here, then all's good. But this is kind of where I am. It's a package deal now. You get all of me, all of the things I've said I never want to experience again in my life. And as I think we're going to see this morning, when we look at the Bible, when we begin to understand God's intention for our lives, we begin to realize that God is never satisfied with this. He's never satisfied with this right here. And what I believe he might want to say to some of us this morning is, don't spend the rest of your life living out of the fears of the past, hiding because something happened in your past. He's like, don't let your past dictate how you live today. And here's the question. There's a million-dollar question. How do you do that? I mean, how do you break through these walls? How do you break through those negative experiences? And so what I want to do is I want to take a look at a very familiar story that we probably all know. Whether you're here for the first time or you've been here at Crosspoint before, we look at this story. It's in Exodus chapter 2. It's the story of Moses. And if it's your first time with us, you know the story because you've seen the movie, right? You've seen Charlton Heston and Moses. And it's fascinating because if the movie is our only reference point, which it's a good movie, by the way, but if that's our only reference point, then, you know, Charlton Heston is like a crazy, handsome dude with crazy leadership. And that doesn't really capture Moses. Moses was not that kind of figure. Moses was a very fearful figure. In fact, Moses was one of the most fearful figures in the entire Bible. And you know, it's interesting because I don't know that you could find another figure more fearful than Moses, and yet it was through that fear and what God did as he addressed that fear, the things that had happened in his past, that actually allowed Moses to change history. So we're going to read a little bit of this story. You can open your Bibles or your apps or whatever it is. If you want to follow along, this will be on the screens. And before we do that, you know why this is a great story? This is a great story because when Moses was alive on this earth, there was a great deal of fear going on all over the world at that point. He lived in constant fear. Every day was a day of fear. Moses was a slave. He was part of a Hebrew nation. The Israelites were slaves in Egypt. At any particular time, you know, your taskmaster could have like a bad day, and he could just kill you or kill your spouse or kill your kids or kill your friends with absolutely no recourse. There was no reason that he couldn't kill you if he wanted to. And so, you know, there's just this heavy sense of life is never going to get better for these people who were in slavery. And then at the same time, the leader of the country, Pharaoh, he was fearful as well. In fact, he was afraid that the nation of Israel, the Israelite people, were eventually going to overpopulate the Egyptian people. So he did something kind of crazy. He called together all the midwives from the Hebrew nation, and he said to them, from this point forward, the midwives are the people who helped deliver the babies for the Israelites, and he said to them, if a Hebrew boy is born, I want you to kill him. Girls can live, Hebrew boys die. So everybody's afraid. Everybody's afraid. Now, there's something really important that happened right here. See, amidst this, and this is kind of a message for another time, but I'll just hit it real quick. Amidst this, there's some heroes that emerge on the scene. And these heroes are the Hebrew midwives. Because they hear this command to kill all the firstborn sons, all the baby boys that are born, and they decide, you know what? Instead of following Pharaoh's orders, we have a fear of God, so we're going to follow God. And this is interesting because, you know, this is from a bunch of midwives who had likely been praying to God, who had been, you know, trusting in God. And this is kind of a God who hasn't really done anything for them lately, all right? It's been over 400 years since they had heard anything from God, since God had evidenced himself in their lives. And yet they say, you know what? We would rather, out of our fear of God, follow God than follow Pharaoh. And it's because of their fear in God that they refused to kill these baby boys. And because of that, Moses actually was born and lived. So here's the story, Exodus chapter 1, last verse of Exodus 1, then Exodus 2. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So he's basically saying, hey, every son, put him in the Nile. Let him drown as babies in the water. Let the crocodiles eat him, whichever come first. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could not hide him any longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. Her sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket along the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister, now this is the boy's sister, all right? Then the boy's sister, the baby boy's sister, asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse your baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Let me pause for a moment. So here we have little Moses. He doesn't even have a name yet. All right, he's picked up in a basket. Pharaoh's daughter finds the basket, and the little boy's sister was kind of watching in the distance. She runs up to Pharaoh's daughter and says, hey, do you want me to go get a mother to nurse this little Hebrew boy? And Pharaoh's daughter said, that would be fantastic. Take a look at what happens next. Verse 9, Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me. I will pay you. So little Moses' mom is now getting a paycheck to raise her daughter. How cool is that, right? I mean, you know, this is like a cool story. Verse 10, so the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. Now, let me stop right here. There's some really cool stuff going on here. If ever there was a fella who should have no sense of fear in his life, if ever there's a guy who should just have this sense that, man, God is with me, it should be Moses, right? I mean, here's a guy that, I mean, it's like, dude, your way is paved in gold. I mean, God's favor is on you. God is so interested in you that you should have nothing to fear. He is going to constantly make your path straight. I mean, first of all, the fear of God was in the midwives, and so they actually delivered you and didn't kill you. That's pretty cool in and of itself. And then your mom was creative and courageous enough to actually put you in a basket, float you down the river in hopes that you might survive, somebody might find you. And then God providentially intervened and didn't let the alligators and the crocodiles, you know, take you out for lunch. And I mean, just, and then who picks you up but Pharaoh's daughter? I mean, this is Pharaoh's daughter. And she then pays your mom to do a job that she normally wouldn't get a paycheck for. I mean, you have found favor with God. And instead of growing up as a slave, guess where you get to grow up, Moses? You get to grow up in Pharaoh's palace, in one of the richest, wealthiest homes in the entire world. I mean, if ever there was a guy who should have grown up fearless, should have grown up with the sense that God has a plan for me, it should have been Moses. I mean, God's fingerprints are all over Moses' life right here. But guess what? Moses missed it. And he missed it, and he becomes one of the most fearful men in the Bible. Why is that? It's because he's just like you and me. I mean, he's just like you and me. His current circumstances overpower his ability to see God at work in his past. Now, let me say something here, because some of you don't believe this right now, right? But I want this to incubate in you as we go for these next few minutes and look at this story. His current circumstances overpower his ability to see God at work in his past. When I sit down with people and they point to the past and they're like, well, why did God let this happen? And if God's a loving God, then why did this take place? And the reason I'm afraid is because. And you know, and these are real life, real feelings, right? Every situation, as I talk and as we talk, and eventually they come to the place where they're able to begin to see the thumbprint of God in their life. All right, and it's not because God wasn't there, but it's just because they couldn't see it. They're so caught up in the current circumstances, they can't see how God is actually working in the situation. So the situation overpowers, it blinds them even to the belief that God's even there. In this story of Moses, God is all over this story. His fingerprints are all over Moses' life. And yet Moses becomes an adult and he has no idea that God has been with him. He has no idea that God has actually prepared a future for him. He couldn't see it. You can't see it. A lot of times I can't see it. And it's not because God is absent, but it's because this fear and this inaccurate interpretation of events prevent us from seeing how God is working in the present. Verse 11. One day, After Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, all right, he kind of did this number because he knew what he was doing right here. And seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw the two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" And then Moses was, what does it say right here? Afraid. He was afraid. And he thought, well, what I did must have become known. When Pharaoh overheard this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat by a well. I mean, so here's this picture. We have this great and powerful Moses, this Moses who God just continues to provide for him, and he's running from Pharaoh. He's running to this place called Midian. And what does he do in Midian? In Midian, he just builds a nice little life for himself. He hid behind his fear. He hides behind his finances. He hides behind this new life. He gets a new wife. He gets new kids. He gets everything new, a new occupation. And he begins to say, I'm just creating my own little life right here. And he thinks every now and then about his people, the hundreds of thousands of people in slavery in Egypt. He's like, I'm never going back there again. They can rot in Egypt for all I care because I don't want to feel what I felt there again. I don't want to experience what I felt, so I'm going to stay behind my nice little wall. This is what Moses does. It's crazy. It's like a kid. I mean, you can see it when we're looking at the story, but he couldn't see it. He made for himself what we're so good at making for ourselves, this nice little wrinkle-free life where we get a new job and, you know, a new set of finances and, you know, some new friends and some new family. And we everything's going great. And we surround ourselves with what we think will be a barrier so we never have to feel or experience what we've experienced in the past. And one day God comes and he interrupts Moses, and kind of like God interrupts us sometimes. I mean, God interrupts me often. He's done that on several occasions. And in his own way, God says, Moses, come out, come out, come out, come on, come out from Midian, come out from behind the wall. He's like, I know everything's under control, but that's not what I have planned for you. And Moses is kind of like, I've been there before, God. I've done that. I don't want to feel those things again. I don't want to experience those things again. And God's like, but Moses, what you're experiencing in Midian, that's not the life I have for you. That's not the things I want you to be doing. That's not the life I created you for. And he's basically like, as long as you use your past as an excuse of why you can't follow me, then I guess you'll have to settle for life behind the wall. The story goes on, Exodus 3:1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. All right, that's pretty cool, right? I mean, the bush is burning, but it's not charring. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone back over to look, God called him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. And then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face. He turned away because he was afraid. Again, here's this word, afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up and out of the land into a good and spacious land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 9. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? In other words, Moses is like, hey, I've been there. I've done that. I'm not going back. I'm never going back there again. He's like, I don't like what I experienced there. I don't like what I felt in that place. I'm staying in Midian. I like my life here. I like the little setup that I have. Everything's kind of in order and I'm protected, so I never have to experience the things that I've experienced on the other side of the wall. And let me just skim through what happens next. Verse 13, look at how Moses excuses himself here. It says, Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, take the God of your fathers has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I say? Chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me? The Lord did not appear to you? I like this part right here. It says, then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? A staff, he replied. The Lord God said, throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground and it became a snake. And guess what? He ran from it. Why did he run from it? Because he's afraid. He's always afraid. Verse 10, Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. Verse 13, but Moses said, he's kind of like, God, pardon me, but I think I'm out on this. Send someone else. He's like, I don't want to go back there. I don't want to try it again. I'm done. I made a commitment to myself. I never experienced, never want to feel what I felt there. And you know what happened over time is Moses eventually came to a point of crisis that some of us come to again and again and again, where he finally, it's like he threw up his arms. He's just like, fine, I'll go. He's like, I don't think it's going to be different. I pretty much know what's going to happen when I go back there. I can't imagine anything's going to turn out good from doing what you've asked me to do. But here's the key right here. Here's the key. He says, but God, you're God and I'm not. So I'll go. And suddenly, it's like in that moment, all of the events of his past, all of his history, all of those bad experiences, all of those places where he couldn't believe how God could let him go, all of that began to change and began to see the significance of every single event, every single painful past memory. And he began to realize that this actually all was being orchestrated for something bigger. Now listen to what I'm going to say right here. Some of you, this is the point of why you're here today. Right, you don't know why you came to Cross Point. You have no idea why you got prompted to maybe come and visit Cross Point for the first time. When you respond to the call of God in your life, it's only then that you begin to recognize his work. Let me say that again. When you respond to the call of God, it's only then. That could be a respond to move. That could be a respond to receive him. There's multiple times God asks us to respond. But it's only in the moment that we begin to make the change that we say, you know, maybe I'll start loving again. Maybe I'll open myself up to trusting again. Maybe I'll give intimacy a shot one more time. Maybe I'll take a risk, you know, one more time. I got burned the last time, but God's promise, maybe I'll try it one more time. And in that ensuing moment, you'll look back and you'll begin to see how God has been at work in every single event in your life. You've just not been able to see it. Let me tell you how this has played out in my life. I think back to when I was in school preparing for what I do today, and I was in a preaching class, and I prepared this sermon, you know, for class, and thought, man, I got to learn how to do this. I never planned to be a senior pastor. I kind of made a deal with God that I'd be a pastor as long as I didn't have to do this. You see how far that got me. And, you know, and so I had to prepare a sermon, and my dad was a pastor at a church, and he heard about this. He said, hey, why don't you come preach your sermon over at my church? And so I'm like, oh, that'd be great. It'd be great experience. So for 3 more months, I prepared this message. I'm building. I'm listening to other people's messages. I'm reading up on my topic, on worry, by the way. And I'm getting all prepared for this thing. And I show up, and I'm in, like, my tie and my coat and my penny loafers, because that's what you wore back then, right? I mean, they were actually in style. And you know, and I'm getting all ready, and I get up to deliver this message I've worked so hard on, right? I give the introduction, and I give my first point, and I kind of break it out, and people are looking in their Bibles, and give the second point. People are, you know, looking through their Bibles, and all of a sudden, I start landing this thing, right? I start landing. I'm like, all right, it's time to bring it home. And I look down at my watch. I've been going for 11 minutes. And then some of you can't even believe I could ever talk for just 11 minutes, all right? And I'm never going back there, all right? But it was 11 minutes, so I thought, man, I planned for 30 minutes. I got to circle back around and teach it all again. So I went back and, like, reiterated every point. And I, you know, just tried to lengthen it out a little bit. And you know, and I kind of finally landed it, and I went down to sit down next to Julie, and we weren't married at the time. We were dating. She leaned over me. She said this very nicely, by the way. There's no mean intent in this phrase at all. But she said, do you know how long you taught this morning? I'm like, no. She said, 16 minutes. I'm like, 16 minutes. And I just thought, oh, my word. That was, I don't know what happened. I mean, that was all I had to give. And you know, it's interesting because as I didn't realize, you know, every single person there that morning, every person who came that morning made a decision in their heart at the end of that morning, that they would probably never come back to that church again. I mean, I think next weekend was their lowest attended weekend ever. But you know, But that was my first shot, right? I thought I was good. I thought, man, I'm going to rock this thing. And I remember when I took my first job, my first ministry position. I was an intern, then quickly became an interim, and then I interviewed for that job and quickly became a youth and college ministries pastor. And I was handed a student ministry of about 60 kids, and I thought, man, this is awesome. I got a whole group of kids who get to shape their lives. And you know, I was confident, had a lot of ego. And I effectively grew that thing to about 20 kids, if we were lucky. And I just thought, man, we gotta drill the Bible into these kids. You know, there's no fun in this place. No fun for you. That was kind of my motto. You know, it was like, we're gonna drill these kids. And that was just a terrible moment. And you know, when I had one of those, 3 years into that, I had one of these, am I gonna even stay in this job? God, I'm ready to bail. I'm ready to go to Midian where I can have a nice little life, make a nice little paycheck, go home, and not have to worry about things when I go home. And yet God, he said, no. I'm shaping. There's something I'm doing in this. And, you know, here I am. I mean, I'd be lying if I told you that I don't think about those things. I mean, because here we're getting in our launch pad in 6-7 weeks. And there's moments where I hear this voice, remember how well you grew that student ministry all the way from 60 to like 15 or 20 kids? Man, Kurt, way to go. I mean, I have those memories. But I can look back now and I can see how, man, you can't even see through the glass because God's fingerprints are so thick all over it. Because every one of those things were very painful at the time, God used to shape to where I am today. Now that's my little story. You know, I ask you, what are you afraid of? Where have you failed and just thought, man, I can't go back there again? You know, what's that wall that you're hiding behind? You know, for some of us, we might need to check into a hospital in the next week or two and deal with our substance abuse. You might be thinking, man, Kurt, I can't do that because I'm going to start feeling things I never want to feel again. No, you got to do that. You got to feel those things if you want to deal with it. You know, control, you know, being critical, the way you discipline or lack of discipline with your kids, whatever it be. What are those things you're afraid of? And you say, I never want to experience that again. You see, some of us, we're afraid of our past. And until we step out from behind the wall that we've erected, we'll never know the adventure that God wants to take us on. You know, Moses thought, man, God, I'm out here on my own. Where have you been lately? And all the while, he realizes God was actually right there holding his hand. Yeah, I don't know where this falls for us this morning. I don't know what's going on in your life. I don't know what of the boxes connects with you, where maybe your walls might be in process of being built, maybe being torn down. But I know that every single one of us has a wall. Why don't you take out your connection cards that Eric asked us to fill out earlier. There's on the back side some next steps. And we're real intentional here at Crosspoint about helping those of you who are here to help to take that next step, to go and say, hey, how can I go to a new place? How can I experience something that helps get me more on the adventure of what God desired for us? And I know that those burning bush experiences, we're going to have those. You probably are having those. You have had those. And you know, you'll argue with God. I mean, God may be having one of those with you right now. You might be sitting here thinking, but God, man, I wrote the letters. I'm not even sure that they read the letters. I just keep writing them. Or God, man, I keep making the call to kind of work through something that happened in the past, and they're not returning my call. How much longer do I have to continue to lay myself out? But God, what if I lose my job again? Man, I'm just going to take something nice and cozy. I'm not going to use my skill set. I'm not going to do the thing you're calling me to because I don't want to take the risk of losing that yet again. But God, what if it was just like the last time? What if it's a repeat performance? But God says, hey, come on. I want you to step out from behind the wall. I want you to follow me. I want you to love again. I want you to trust again. I want you to be willing to take a risk again. I'm going to be holding your hand. I'm going to go right along the way. I'm not going to leave you there. Get in church again. Pray again. I don't know what it is. You know, maybe you feel like God left you out to dry once and didn't come through. Maybe God was all over that and you just missed seeing how he was in the midst of that moment. So I want to ask you to take a moment and just read through these next steps. And, you know, you might be piqued by today and your next step might just be coming back and trying church for a second week. But maybe there's some other things that God's prompting you to begin to get after. So read through these next steps and take a moment and identify what you're going to do as your next step this week. And then I want to pray for us. All right, let's go ahead and stand to our feet. Let me pray for us this morning. God, I know that there's a lot of spiritual stuff going on right now. It's a very spiritual moment. Even though we're marking a card, we're making decisions of what we're going to be walking out this week. And God, it's kind of crazy for me to say this, but I actually thank you for those many, many difficult burning bush moments that I've had. And God, I know I'll have another round. I know that I'll have rounds where I have to learn to trust you again, tearing down walls. I mean, that's just all a part of the cycle of life. And God, I pray that some of us in this room right now would even, in these moments right now, begin this process. Father, I just pray for the single guys sitting here, the single gal sitting here this morning, that you just give them courage to open up and say yes to you. God, for the couple in here today, he's scared to love his wife like Christ loved the church because he's afraid she's going to walk all over him again. God, I just pray that you give him the courage to say yes to you despite the past. God, whatever it is, it's holding us behind the wall. God, I just pray that you begin to break that down in these moments. God, in your grace and your mercy, God, I just pray that you open our hearts, open our eyes to see your thumbprints all over our past. God, help us to see that you've been walking alongside. You've been actually guiding us, shaping, developing, using our past to break us out of self-centeredness, using our past to break us out of ego, using our past to break us out of pride. Things that have to be removed before we could be what you want us to be. So God, I just pray that you do what only you can do in these moments right here. And help us to step out from behind the wall.